This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
So glad to be here with our listeners and happy everyone's with us. We have our usual wonderful mix of stories coming from the front page of the New York Times. I'm smarter every time I read these stories. And we start in Mexico City with an article titled, "Mexico City Has Long Thirsted for Water. The Crisis is Worsening." A system of dams and canals may soon be unable to provide water to one of the world's largest cities. A confluence of unchecked growth, crumbling infrastructure, and a changing climate. A collision of climate change, urban sprawl, and poor infrastructure has pushed Mexico City to the brink of a profound water crisis. The groundwater is quickly vanishing. A key reservoir got so low that it is no longer used to supply water. Last year was Mexico's hottest and driest in at least 70 years. And one of the city's main water systems faces a potential day zero this summer when levels dip so much that it too will no longer provide water. We're suffering because the city is growing immeasurably and it cannot be stopped, said Gabrielle Martinez, 64, who lives in an apartment complex that struggles to get enough water for its roughly 600 residents. There aren't enough resources. Mexico City, once a water-rich valley that was drained to make way for a vast city, has a metropolitan population of 23 million, among the top 10 largest in the world, and up from 15 million just in 1990. It is one of several major cities facing severe water shortages, including Cape Town, Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Chennai, India. Many are the consequence of years of poor water management, compounded by scarce rains. And while Mexico City's problems are worsening, they are not new. Some neighborhoods have lacked adequate piped water for years. But today, communities that have never had shortages are suddenly facing them. Experts were warning about dwindling water supplies almost two decades ago, to little avail. If the capital's water network was already held together by a thread, then, now some parts of the system are falling apart, said Manuel Perlo-Cohen, an urban planning researcher who studies Mexico City's water system. Mexico is the biggest market in the world for bottled water, said Roberto Constantino Toto, who heads the water research office at the Metropolitan Autonomous University in Mexico City. It is a reflection, he added, of the failure of our water policy. Exceptionally dry conditions are the immediate source of the city's water plight. Mexico has long been vulnerable to droughts, but nearly 68% of the country is in moderate or extreme drought, according to the National Water Commission. The Cuzamala water system, one of the world's largest networks of dams, canals, and pipes, that supplies 27% of the capital's water, is at a historical low 30% of its normal capacity, official figures show. At the same point last year, it was at 38%, and in 2022, it stood at 45%. Officials have projected June 26th as an estimated day zero, when the Cutzamala system could drop to the 20% baseline where it would no longer be tapped to provide water to Mexico City. The water level at one reservoir fell so low that officials halted its use in April. It's sad, Juan Carlos Moran Castilla, 52, a fisherman who lives along the reservoir, said as he stood on heat-cracked ground that was once underwater. Groundwater, which supplies most of the city's water, is pumped out as fast as it is replenished, experts said. The city's water supply, some of which is brought in from far away, flows through old pipes along an 8,000-mile-long grid, vulnerable to earthquakes and sinking ground, and where leaks have caused an estimated 35% water loss, more than the Cutzamala system provides. The city's water challenge has become an issue in elections next month. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, whose aides have said that day zero will not happen, has insisted that his government is already addressing Mexico City's water problems. New wells were being dug, he said, and officials were working to end corruption involving water consumed by big industries. He has also proposed bringing more water in from outside the city. Claudia Sheinbaum, Mr. López Obrador's protege, who resigned as Mexico City mayor last year to become the leading presidential candidate, has defended her administration's handling of the water crisis. Scientists, she said recently, could not have predicted the prolonged drought, and if elected president, she would present an ambitious plan to fix the issues. The National Water Commission did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Some areas of Mexico City have long been without sufficient tap water, including Iztapalapa, a working-class community and the capital's most populous borough with 1.8 million people. Residents rely on municipal water trucks to fill cisterns or water tanks in homes or buildings. If that is not enough, people pay for private trucks or, in extreme cases, illegally tap water lines. But as water has become scarcer, other areas of the city are facing increased rationing, including reduced flow and getting water during only certain times of the day or on certain days of the week. Water has been rationed to 284 neighborhoods this year, even to more affluent ones, compared with 147 in 2007. Boroughs that have never suffered from water problems in their life are going to have to really learn how to take care of it, said Adriana Gutierrez, 50, who manages and lives in a 154-unit apartment complex in Iztapalapa that relies on water trucks. Residents treat every drop as precious, using water from showers to clean their homes. For 20 years, Dan Ortega Hernandez, 50, never had a problem with running water at his barbershop in Mexico City's Tlalpan borough. But in November, he said he turned on the faucet and nothing came out. Now, when he does get running water under the rationing plan, he fills a 1,100-liter tank and hopes it lasts until the next scheduled day for running water. That is a more regular supply than at his home elsewhere in Tlalpan. He said municipal water trucks used to come every 4 days or so, but now take longer, sometimes up to a month. Rather than using water at home, he washes the family's clothes at a laundromat near his shop. "It's scary that we're running out of resources," he said. There is no evidence that Mexico's drought is attributable to climate change, but the effects are made worse by rising temperatures. Mexico City's average temperatures rose by about 3 degrees Celsius, or 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit, in the past century, more than double the global average. Exceptionally hot days, above 30 degrees Celsius or 86 degrees Fahrenheit, have doubled in some parts of the city, according to a 2020 study. That could partly be because of climate change and partly because of the city's exponential growth, with concrete and asphalt replacing trees and wetlands. Heat aggravates a water crisis. People need more water, and more water evaporates. The latest Water Risk Atlas, published by the World Resources Institute, describes Mexico City as facing extremely high water stress, its highest category. As Mexico prepares to head to the polls to elect a new president, the water problems have been largely overshadowed by other topics like crime and the economy. Water has, however, been a main focus of the mayoral race. Water will reach the entire city regardless of where people live, one candidate said. The leaks that the governing party failed to repair will be fixed, another proclaimed. A master plan will be put in place, a third added, to unearth buried rivers that run through the capital. Now everybody is like, "Yeah, I'm going to solve the water problem," Dr. Perlo said. "But I've heard this story many times before." Some progress has been made. An enormous $2 billion tunnel opened in 2019 to take wastewater from Mexico City to a distant water treatment plant. A program to harvest unutilized rainwater has launched in some poor neighborhoods. A small section of Lake Texcoco, largely drained to build the city, was restored. More wells and aquifers are being explored. But several experts said the steps taken so far have not been aggressive enough, and others ill-directed. Most of the focus by city and national governments has been on seeking faraway watersheds that supply other Mexican states to quench Mexico City's thirst. But the majority of the water's treatment plants do not operate at full capacity. Many let wastewater go untreated, which is then just discharged into rivers or lakes, polluting what could be alternative sources of water. Excuse me. The estimated price tag for addressing the water crisis reaches as high as $13.5 billion, according to the city's water agency. The rainy season, which typically runs roughly June to November, would usually help replenish Mexico City's water systems. But the capital saw historically low rainfalls during last year's rainy season. The day zero warning by some experts has been a flashpoint in Mexico City, used to bash the governing party, which includes Mr. López Obrador and Ms. Sheinbaum. But it has also helped train the public's attention to the deepening problem. "It creates a feeling of fear, anxiety, worry," said Fabiola Sosa Rodriguez, a water management and climate policy researcher. Lizbeth Martinez Garcia, 26, who lives in a hillside community in Iztapalapa, where a weekly municipal water truck fills the tanks that supply the four families in her building, said she asked the delivery man about the future. He told her, she said, that the future meant even less water. "We're scared," she said. So what's happening in Mexico City is echoing around the world. It will be an increasing problem by all reports. Our next article comes back north to the United States, specifically to Washington, and it's titled, "A New Centrism is Rising in Washington." Call it neopopulism, a bipartisan attitude that mistrusts the free market ethos instead of embracing it. And this, it may be the most discussed fact about American politics today. The country is deeply polarized. The Republican Party has moved to the right by many measures, and the Democratic Party has moved to the left. Each party sees the other as an existential threat. One consequence of this polarization, politicians and pundits often say, is gridlock in Washington. But in a country that is supposed to have a gridlocked federal government, the past 4 years are hard to explain. These years have been arguably the most productive period of Washington bipartisanship in decades. During the COVID pandemic, Democrats and Republicans in Congress came together to pass emergency responses. Under President Biden, bipartisan majorities have passed major laws on infrastructure and semiconductor chips, as well as laws on veterans' health, gun violence, the postal service, the aviation system, same-sex marriage, anti-Asian hate crimes, and the electoral process. On trade, the Biden administration has kept some of the Trump administration's signature policies and even expanded them. The trend has continued over the past month, first with the passage of a bipartisan bill to aid Ukraine and other allies and to force a sale of TikTok by its Chinese owner. After the bill's passage, far-right House Republicans tried to oust Speaker Mike Johnson because he did not block it, and House Democrats voted to save Johnson's job. There is no precedent for House members of one party to rescue a speaker from the other. Last week, the House advanced another bipartisan bill on disaster relief, using a rare procedural technique to get around party line votes. This flurry of bipartisanship may be surprising, but it is not an accident. It has depended on the emergence of a new form of American centrism. The very notion of centrism is anathema to many progressives and conservatives, conjuring a mushy moderation. But the new centrism is not always so moderate. Forcing the sale of a popular social app is not exactly timid, nor is it confronting China and Russia. The bills to rebuild American infrastructure and strengthen the domestic semiconductor industry are ambitious economic policies. A defining quality of the new centrism is how much it differs from the centrism that guided Washington in the roughly quarter century after the end of the Cold War, starting in the 1990s. That centrism, alternately called the Washington Consensus or neoliberalism, was based on the idea that market economies had triumphed. by lowering trade barriers and ending the era of big government. The United States would both create prosperity for its own people and shape the world in its image, spreading democracy to China, Russia, and elsewhere. That hasn't worked out. In the U.S., incomes and wealth have grown slowly, except for the affluent, while life expectancy is lower today than in any other high-income country. Although China, along with other once poor countries, has become richer, it is less free and increasingly assertive. The new centrism is a response to these developments. It is a recognition that neoliberalism failed to deliver. The notion that the old approach would bring prosperity, as Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, has said, was a promise made, not kept. It, in its place, has risen a new worldview. Call it neopopulism. Both Democrats and Republicans have grown skeptical of free trade. On Tuesday, Biden announced increased tariffs on several Chinese-made goods in response to Beijing's subsidies. Democrats and a slice of Republicans have also come to support industrial policy, in which the government tries to address the market's shortcomings. The infrastructure and semiconductor laws are examples. These policies feel more consistent with the presidencies of Dwight Eisenhower or Franklin Roosevelt than those of Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton. The term neopopulism is apt, partly because polls show these new policies to be more popular than the planks of the Washington Consensus ever were. Decades ago, politicians of both parties pushed for liberalizing global trade despite public skepticism. In retrospect, many politicians and even some economists believe that Americans were right to be skeptical. There is a sense on both the left and right, and among many independents, that the economy hasn't been working in many places. Ro Khanna, a progressive House Democrat whose district includes Silicon Valley, told me. Daniel DeSalvo, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank, said that more Republicans have woken up to the fact that neoliberal policies didn't work out so well for a large coalition of working people. As was the case during the 20th century, another important factor is the international rivalry. Then it was the Cold War. Now it is the battle against an emerging autocratic alliance that is led by China and includes Russia, North Korea, Iran, and groups like Hamas and the Houthis. China is a unifying force, absolutely, Senator Susan Collins, a Maine Republican, told me. Senator John Fetterman, a Pennsylvania Democrat, compared the rise of artificial intelligence to the Soviet Union's loss of the Sputnik satellite in 1957, which led to bipartisan legislation on education and scientific research. Anxiety about AI, Fetterman added, made possible the passage of the semiconductor chips bill. We are most able to come together when we acknowledge the risks we have to the American way of life, Fetterman said. And whose side are you on? Democracy or Putin, Hamas, and China? There are certainly limits to the new centrism. The Republican Party has a large isolationist wing, and some progressives question whether American power is a good thing. The Supreme Court, dominated by Republican appointees, largely supports laissez-faire economics. On some divisive social issues, like abortion, the prospect of bipartisan federal legislation is scant. Then there is Donald Trump. He is in some ways part of the new consensus, but he is also hostile to basic democratic traditions, including an independent judiciary and the peaceful transfer of power. If he becomes president again, his promised agenda is sufficiently extreme that it may chill bipartisan cooperation. Still, the forces that have created neopopulism are unlikely to disappear. They reflect enduring economic and international trends, as well as public opinion. I don't mean to suggest everything is fine, because it clearly isn't, said Collins, a longtime advocate for bipartisanship. But I do think the pendulum is starting to swing back. That's a positive story, I think, about collaboration between different philosophies in our governing bodies. Now we will go to Israel and have an article titled "Israel's Wartime Government Frays as Frustration with Netanyahu Grows." Benny Gantz, a centrist member of leadership, presented the prime minister with an ultimatum that demanded a plan for the future of Israel's war. Benny Gantz, a centrist member of Israel's war cabinet, presented Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with an ultimatum on Saturday, saying he would leave the government if it did not soon develop a plan for the future of the war in Gaza. While Mr. Gantz's departure would not topple the country's emergency wartime government, the move would further strain a fragile coalition that has provided Mr. Netanyahu's far-right government with a boost of international legitimacy, and it would make the prime minister even more reliant on his hard-line partners. If you choose the path of zealots dragging the country into the abyss, we will be forced to leave the government, Mr. Gantz said in a televised news conference. We will turn to the people and build a government that will earn the people's trust. Mr. Gantz, who leads the National Unity Party, said he would give Mr. Netanyahu until June 8th, 3 weeks' time, to develop a plan that would aim to secure the release of hostages taken to Gaza by Hamas-led militants on October 7th, address the future governments of the territory, return displaced Israelis to their homes, and advance normalization with Saudi Arabia, among other issues. Mr. Gantz's ultimatum was the latest sign of pressure building on Mr. Netanyahu to develop a post-war plan. The prime minister is increasingly being squeezed externally from Israel's closest ally, the United States, and from within his own war cabinet, to clarify a strategy for Gaza. Just days earlier, Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, said the government was charting a dangerous course and demanded that Mr. Netanyahu immediately pledge not to establish an Israeli military government in Gaza. In a response to Mr. Gantz's ultimatum, Mr. Netanyahu accused the former military chief of staff and a longtime political rival of calling for Israeli defeat by effectively allowing Hamas to remain in power. Mr. Gantz, he added, was choosing to place ultimatums for the price for the prime minister rather than for Hamas. Domestic frustration is also mounting over Mr. Netanyahu's failure to secure the freedom of the hostages remaining in Gaza. Israeli forces on Saturday recovered the body of an Israeli man held in Gaza since October 7th, the fourth body recovered in 2 days, raising fears about the fates of roughly 128 captives still in the enclave. Even as Israeli politicians wrestled with how to finish the war, the effects of the current strategy were playing out in Gaza. Israeli ground forces pressed onward in the eastern outskirts of the city of Rafah on Saturday, the Israeli military said. In a statement on Saturday morning, Hamas said its fighters had fired on Israeli troops in eastern Rafah, as well as close to the Rafah border crossing. As the war enters its eighth month, more than 34,000 people have died in Gaza, according to the health authorities there. But the Israeli military has otherwise made slow progress in reaching the government's stated goals of dismantling Hamas and freeing the hostages. Negotiations over a ceasefire that would release a number of hostages have stalled, with Israel and Hamas at odds over the conditions for a truce. Israeli troops have also had to return to parts of northern Gaza to combat a renewed Hamas insurgency. And Israeli forces and Hezbollah, the politically powerful Lebanese armed group, continue to bombard one another across the border, leaving tens of thousands of Israelis displaced with little idea when they might return home. Mr. Gantz joined the Israeli government after October 7th as an emergency wartime measure. The result has been a fragile and fractious coalition, with Mr. Gantz and his allies trading fire with Mr. Netanyahu's far-right allies and occasionally the prime minister himself. To some extent, both Mr. Gantz and Mr. Gantz's criticisms echoed those of U.S. officials. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said this week that Israel had to produce a clear, concrete plan for post-war governance in Gaza. The United States has sought to empower the Palestinian Authority, the group that controls much of the occupied West Bank, to govern Gaza. But Mr. Netanyahu and his allies have rejected that idea, proposing that Palestinians unaffiliated with Hamas or the PA take over. The Biden administration has also called for the establishment of a Palestinian state, of which Gaza would be an integral part, a proposal that has lost support in Israel since the Hamas-led terrorist attack on October 7th. On Saturday, Mr. Gantz vowed not to allow any party, whether friends or enemies, to impose a Palestinian state upon us, echoing Mr. Netanyahu's rhetoric opposing Palestinian sovereignty. Until a permanent solution is found, Mr. Gantz said, Gaza should be temporarily run by an American, European, Arab, Palestinian civil administration with Israeli security oversight. Mr. Gantz joined Mr. Netanyahu in dismissing any role for the internationally backed PA. The discovery of dead hostages and a resurgence of Hamas fighting in recent days has highlighted the failures of Mr. Netanyahu's current strategy. Israeli forces said on Saturday that they had recovered the body of Ron Binyamin, 53, an Israeli man, and the fourth hostage brought back to Israel for burial over the past 2 days. Around 124 of the more than 250 people taken hostage on October 7th are still in Gaza, according to the Israeli authorities. Another four captives have been held there for years, since well before the Hamas attack. At least 35 of the remaining hostages are presumed dead, according to Israeli government statistics. As fighting in Gaza has intensified near the southern city of Rafah, the flow of aid to the enclave has dwindled. Trucks laden with humanitarian aid began rolling onto the shores of Gaza this week through a temporary pier built by the United States. But American officials and aid groups emphasize that the new sea corridor could not replace land border crossings, the most efficient way of getting supplies to the territory's civilians. Only 310 aid trucks have entered Gaza through those crossings in the 10 days since Israel began its military incursion in the southern city of Rafah, United Nations officials said on Friday. That is far shy of the more than 500 a day that aid organizations say is needed to maintain even minimally acceptable living conditions. Humanitarian workers have repeatedly warned that famine is looming amid severe shortages of basic goods among civilians, many of whom have been displaced multiple times. More than 800,000 Palestinians have been forced to flee Rafah since Israel began a military offensive on May 6th, according to UNRWA, the primary UN agency for Palestinians. Israel continues to characterize its offensive in and around Rafah as a limited operation against Hamas, but recent satellite imagery showed widening destruction and suggested that a significant incursion was already underway. On Thursday, Israel said it would send more forces to Rafah, signaling that it intended to attack deeper into the city despite international concerns about the threat to civilians posed by a full-scale invasion. Rafah has become home to more than 1 million Palestinians who fled their homes elsewhere in Gaza, seeking a modicum of safety, even as the Israeli military continued to carry out airstrikes on the city. It was one of the last places that had not been invaded by Israeli soldiers. Now, many Palestinians are seeking shelter in places like the central city of Deir al-Balah and al-Mawasi, a coastal area west of Khan Yunis. Both are overcrowded and facing dire conditions, UN and aid groups have said. In the north, Israeli attacks and new military evacuation orders have displaced more than 160,000 people from several areas around Gaza City, according to UNRWA. The situation there doesn't look to be resolving anytime soon. We'll stop our coverage of it there. As if the wars on Earth weren't enough, now we get a story that talks about a new Star Wars plan. Pentagon rushes to counter threats in orbit. Citing rapid advances by China and Russia, the United States is building an extensive capacity to fight battles in space. The Pentagon is rushing to expand its capacity to wage war in space, convinced that rapid advances by China and Russia in space-based operations pose a growing threat to U.S. troops and other military assets on the ground and American satellites in orbit. Details of the push by the Pentagon remain highly classified, but Defense Department officials have increasingly acknowledged that the initiative reflects a major shift in military operations as space increasingly becomes a battleground. No longer will the United States simply rely on military satellites to communicate, navigate, and track and target terrestrial threats. Tools that for decades have given the Pentagon a major advantage in conflicts. Instead, the Defense Department is looking to acquire a new generation of ground and space-based tools that will allow it to defend its satellite network from attack and, if necessary, to disrupt or disable enemy spacecraft in orbit, Pentagon officials have said in a series of interviews, speeches, and recent statements. The strategy differs fundamentally from previous military programs in space by expanding the range of offensive capabilities. A far cry from the never-built 1980s-era strategic defense initiative proposal, for example, which was focused on using satellites to protect the U.S. from nuclear missile strikes. We must protect our space capabilities while also being able to deny an adversary the hostile use of its space capabilities, General Chance Saltzman, the Chief of Space Operations at Space Force, the agency created in 2019 as a new division of the Air Force Department to lead the effort, said in March. Because if we do not have space, we lose. Pentagon officials and a recent unclassified assessment by the Director of National Intelligence say that both Russia and China have already tested or deployed systems such as ground-based high-energy lasers, anti-satellite missiles, or maneuverable satellites that could be used to disrupt American space assets. The concern has only escalated with reports that Russia may be developing a space-based nuclear weapon that could broadly wipe out satellites in orbit, both commercial and military. Russia's use of electronic jamming tools during the war in Ukraine, which have at times disrupted advanced American weapons systems, is cited by Pentagon officials as another reason the United States must intensify its defenses in space. It is now not theoretical, General Stephen Whiting, who oversees Space Command, which is responsible for using space assets to defend the United States, said in a meeting with reporters last month during a space industry conference in Colorado. It's real. It's deployed out in the environment, he said. But the move to enhance warfighting capacity in space is driven mostly by China's expanding fleet of military tools in space. China has fielded a number of space capabilities designed to target our forces, Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall said in an interview. And we're not going to be able to operate in the Western Pacific successfully unless we can defeat those. General Whiting said China has tripled its network of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance satellites since 2018, which he described as a kill web over the Pacific Ocean to find, fix, track, and yes, target United States and allied military capabilities. The government officials in China and Russia have rejected these assertions, arguing that it is the United States that is driving the militarization of space. The United States has long been repeatedly hyping up China as a threat in outer space to smear and attack China, said a Chinese government statement issued earlier this year, calling this effort only an excuse for the U.S. to expand its forces in outer space and maintain military hegemony. In pushing back against American claims, Russia and China unsuccessfully urged the United Nations Security Council last month to prevent for all time the placement of weapons in outer space. John Plum, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Space Policy, called the Russian and Chinese proposal made after the United States pushed for a resolution reiterating that nuclear weapons should not be deployed in space, impossible to verify and enforce, and hypocritical because both Russia and China are deploying weapons. Militarization of space is unavoidable, he added. The history of humanity is where there are military advantages. The military will operate, Mr. Plum said in an interview. People will try to neutralize those advantages and try to exploit those advantages, and space is no different. American officials are instead moving ahead with an effort they are calling Responsible Counter-Space Campaigning, an intentionally ambiguous term that avoids directly confirming that the United States intends to put its own weapons in space. But it also is meant to reflect this commitment by the United States to pursue its interest in space without creating massive debris fields that would result in an explosive device or missile were used to blow up an enemy satellite. That is what happened in 2007 when China used a missile to blow up a satellite in orbit. United States, China, India, and Russia all have tested such missiles, but the United States vowed in 2022 not to do any such anti-satellite tests again. The United States has also long had ground-based systems that allow it to jam radio signals, disrupting the ability of an enemy to communicate with its satellites, and is already taking steps to modernize these systems. But under its new approach, the Pentagon is moving to take on an even more ambitious task, broadly suppress enemy threats in orbit in a fashion similar to what the Navy does in the oceans and the Air Force in the skies. One of the top priorities is so-called force protection, meaning the ability of the Space Force to ensure that other branches of the military are not threatened as a result of enemy use of satellites to find and target them before their units reach a battlefield. Achieving space superiority through effective suppression of enemy space capabilities is how a recently updated Pentagon warfighter doctrine describes this tactic. Given how classified this work is, Pentagon officials declined to discuss the details. Aides to General Saltzman canceled a planned interview with the New York Times after they were told that he would be asked about specific warfighting tools. There's value in ambiguity, so potential competitors and strategic competitors have to figure out what we're doing, General Whiting said when separately asked by the Times about the Space Force's efforts. But there are hints, including a recent report drafted by Charles Galbraith, a former Space Force colonel. He cited three examples that could disable enemy satellite networks: cyber attacks, ground or space-based lasers, and high-powered microwaves. One Pentagon-funded report, as far back as the 1990s, proposed building a space-based hunter-killer satellite that would send a beam of high energy toward enemy satellites to burn out their electronics, predicting that it could be part of Air Force operations as of 2025. Okay, I'm sure we will be hearing more about that, although it is kind of an invisible set of strategies. It's interesting to hear about. Our final article today, to me, is heartbreaking and sheds light on perhaps an invisible part of our society. And it's titled, When Tommy Rath Vanished from the Jungle. He was ensnared in Ithaca's homeless encampment. Then, in a blur of violence, he was gone. The sprawling homeless encampment behind a stand of big box stores has been around so long that people in upstate New York City of Ithaca call it by name, as if referring to a neighborhood or historic district. Police dispatchers use the term as a geographic point of reference. There's a very large fire coming from the jungle behind Carpet Warehouse. The jungle. Tucked beside railroad tracks that course through gnarly woods, the encampment harbors the disenfranchised and distrusting, the addicted and the unwell, the vulnerable and the predatory. It is an off-the-grid community, a hideout, a drug den, a home for people with nowhere else to go, a place of freedom and fire, overdose and escape, where the police are uncertain of their role and first responders enter with caution. But the jungle reflects more than the often intertwined plagues of drug addiction, mental illness, and homelessness. It is also a manifestation of the policies of a proudly progressive city of 33,000 people that, like so many other communities around the country, is struggling to find a solution to its island of misery. Recent walks into the jungle were journeys through the detritus of desperation. Discarded shopping carts, soggy plush toys, used needles, pilfered building supplies. In one corner, a mountain of stolen bicycles, dozens and dozens, loomed like a metal skeletal monument to lawlessness. The residents live in tents or sheltered made of tarps and pallets or makeshift compounds emanating curls of wood smoke. Scorch marks on the ground betray where campsites have burned down or been burned down as a result of jungle justice. If the encampment has a mascot, it is the lost cat, a forlorn figure painted on buildings, bridges, and pretty much anything else inanimate. Its creator, a volatile jungle resident, died last year. Overdose. Just a very dark place, recalled Cassandra Borland, 55, who lived in the jungle for a year and a half before escaping. Now a health home care manager, she likened the encampment's pull to the entangling vines of the undergrowth. You can feel the grip of it in your arms, over your shoulders, and around your neck, she said, and you know you're going to die. Among those ensnared in the jungle was a specter of a man who possessed little more than his name, Thomas Rath. Tommy, to those who knew him the longest. A 33-year-old addict living in a tarp and wood hut, he was out of touch with his distraught family, out of work, out of it. He was also frightened, confiding in a friend that some people were out to get him. Last spring, on a late May Saturday that dawned sunny but grayed by the hour, Mr. Rath was beaten, zip-tied, and taken away from the jungle. For months afterward, his violent vanishing haunted both the Rath family and the city of Ithaca. the unnerving question hanging over its forlorn sanctuary behind the big box stores. What happened to Tommy Rath? The struggles of Tommy Rath are freeze-framed in family photographs. Here he is, a strapping 190 pounds, beaming as he holds his baby daughter. And here, just a couple of years later, but 50 pounds thinner, awkward in someone else's clothes. He spent his formative years in the Finger Lakes community of Fayette, about 40 miles north of Ithaca. "Always into the adrenaline sports," said his father, also named Thomas Rath. "Skateboarding, trail biking, cliff jumping, forever on the move." Friends admired him. As a teenager, he once ate an earthworm on a dare from Brent Doyle, cementing a fraternal bond. As a young adult, he met a 15-year-old living on his own named Kenny Pollitt and took him under his wing. Later, he studied a Rocky Alex Capilongo, who recalled that Tommy wiped more tears from my eyes than anyone I know. And unfortunately, I won't be able to go on with this story. It does not end well for Mr. Tommy Rath, and is an insight into life in homeless camps. This is Beth Brann, wishing you each a wonderful week ahead.